So that's why capitalization rate valuations, appraisers and buyers and brokers would use a lower cap rate, like in New York City, might be a 5% cap rate, whereas in Fairfield, Iowa, where Marishi International University is, you know, the cap rate might need to be at least 10%, maybe 12%.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at Procurement Express. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Today, I've got Charlie Fritsch, CEO of HIA. And Charlie has a long background and history in the hospitality industry, hotels specifically. And we're going to talk today about what it takes to get the maximum valuation when it comes to selling a hotel business from a finance perspective, or maybe even what you need to watch out for if you're in the other side of the table and you want to start doing some of these higher function activities that CFOs should be doing, looking at roll-ups, valuations, exits, all this sort of stuff. That's where the real value is to be added. So Charlie, thanks for coming along. Maybe you could just give us a quick intro. Where are you in the world and tell us a bit about your background?
Yeah, thanks, James. Charlie Fritsch, founder and CEO of Hotel Investor Apps. We are based in Glenwood, Maryland, which is a little hamlet, you could say, just west of Columbia, Maryland, or to reference bigger cities, we're outside of Washington, D.C. and Baltimore.
Just to give us a bit of a history lesson, where did you graduate or what sort of schooling did you have and how did you get into hospitality in the first place?
Yeah, so I grew up in Baltimore County, suburban, middle-class neighborhood. Nobody in my family had gone to college. But I went to a public school. And then I went to, you could call it a junior college, community college. For the first 2 years, it was less expensive. From the community college, I transferred. And actually, I graduated from Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa, which is fully accredited to PhD, but has a focus based on the founder of the Transcendental Meditation Organization, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And so the students and faculty practice TM, Transcendental Meditation. And so that's where I graduated college. The funny thing is, when I went to college, the last thing I wanted to study was business. I got out of college and went into business. So go figure. I had intentions potentially of going, you know, and getting a master's and PhD and maybe teaching in colleges. But then I found out what college professors were making at the time, which wasn't a whole lot. And I also got married in 1978 and to raise a family that didn't look that great on a professor's salary at the time. So I started a business. So right out of college, I became an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. My first business was growing alfalfa sprouts. And then I got into commercial real estate about 8 years later, 7 years later, bought my first historic hotel. Funny story. So I used an investment grade ruby for the deposit to buy this hotel. We arranged financing. We arranged five different loans. We used none of our own money, and we walked out of the closing with a check in our hand.
Wow.
But that was 1984. It's a lot tougher to do that kind of thing today. So anyway, that was my beginning in real estate and hotels, although we didn't renovate that as a hotel. But I started in real estate then, and then I got out of the produce business, out of growing alfalfa sprouts, and got my real estate license and fairly quickly had listed a hotel and sold it and then decided that was what I was going to focus on, was listing and selling hotels. So that first hotel I sold, we closed in 1996. Then I did hotel brokerage, having licenses in 14 states in the U.S., having sold in 30 states, a few international deals, I worked on. And as I was selling hotels, obviously, when you're positioning a hotel for sale, you're looking at the output of the accounting software.
Just before we get into that, because you said a few things that are really interesting. One is, we established you didn't have a silver spoon in your mouth when you started out. We're setting up the classic entrepreneur story, rags to riches here. And then the second thing is, education you had was non-standard compared to a lot of your competitors or peers, let's say. Do you think that brought you any advantage or a different worldview that helped you?
Definitely the practice of transcendental meditation, which I still do today, twice a day, is, I felt then and always has given me an advantage in business. For one, you maintain a more centered, calm focus and don't get upset about little things and, you know, and sometimes wild swings in business when you work for yourself. And so it does, that helped a lot. And at Murray Sheen International University, the intellectual part of the meditation program was the science of creative intelligence, is what Maharishi Mahesh Yogi called it. But it's basically principles of sort of natural law of how the universe expresses itself. Principles like the nature of life is to grow. And so those principles, I think, were a different perspective in my college education. And I think that helped me as well. As a hotel broker, I've lived a very comfortable life, been successful, been able to raise sticks, wonderful kids. So it's been good. Others have made faster, greater success. But from the hotel real estate brokerage, kind of branched off and became this hotel software business.
Your story reminds me of Ronald Reagan has a quote, which my dad comes up with every now and again, which is that, you know, there are people who chase prairie dogs and people who chase bison. Is that the case? Like, you could have sold houses and you just saw, well, why would I bother with a house? And I can just...
Why sell a house for $500,000 when you can sell a hotel for $5 million or $50 million? So, yeah. And even though the percentage does decline as the dollar amount goes up and up, like, you know, I had a deal working on a hotel in Manhattan for $92 million. The commission on that was 1%, but still, you know, it was with 900,000. So the dollar amount increases, even if the percentage goes down. What I've learned in the software business, basically, it's harder to scale up if your, you know, annual contract value is small. So you've got to have some really broad product to and be easily self-onboarding, basically. If you've got a more complicated product that needs a lot of high touch, then it's got to be higher dollar. And so that's a true principle.
So I'm getting an image here of, because it's got to be stressful working as a broker. I know real estate brokers who sell houses here, the ones I know give up after a while because life's too short. And even at a hotel, it's got to be more stressful. So I have an image of you bringing this calmness to the situation.
Particularly with a hotel, when one transaction, you know, it could be a third of, if not half of your income for the year. And buyers and sellers, as they often do for a, say, a $10 million asset, they disagree, they haggle, they negotiate, sometimes right up to and including at the closing table, you know, and the buyer says, I'm not paying for that. And the seller says, I'm not paying for that. And then they look at me and say, well, you got to pay for it. So,
right. So let's get into a little bit to some basics on how hotels are valued. What's a bargain look like?
Right. So I started selling hotels in 1996, officially. In 1999, I took a computerized hotel valuation course at Cornell Hotel School. So it was only a week-long course for professionals who were already in the business, but it was taught by the leading hotel valuation appraisal company owner, Steve Rushmore of HVS, Hospitality Valuation Services. He taught basically, so it was a discounted cash flow model. You project what the revenue income you're going to get, the cash flow from that hotel, say for 5 years or 10 years, whatever your hold period might be. And then you discount that total cash flow over that hold period, 5, 10 years. to present day value to come up with a valuation. So that's one method. Some owners use a simpler method, which is basically a gross room revenue multiple. And for limited service hotels, simpler hotels like a limited service Hampton Inn or a Holiday Inn Express or Comfort Inn or a Fairfield Inn by Marriott, then that gross room revenue multiple of 3 times, 4 times, depending on the location, sometimes it was 5 times the gross room revenue, that could make sense because the owner, the buyer would say, well, I don't really care what your expenses are. I know what it's going to cost me to run this hotel. So I'm willing to pay this much so I know I'll have this much profits. So gross room revenue multiple is another formula. You could say kind of a rule of thumb. There's another valuation tool that a friend of mine, a professor at Penn State Hotel School, wrote an article about called the ADR rule of thumb, which is average daily rate. And then you take that average daily rate. Let's say it's $100 average for that rate for that guest room at that Hampton Inn. And you multiply that times 1,000. And that is the price per key of the value for that Hampton Inn. And then if it's a 100-room Hampton Inn, so $100 ADR times 1,000 is $100,000 times 100 rooms is $10 million. So that is a $10 million hotel. So that's another metric that's used, but mostly larger transactions, they're looking at the capitalization rate, which is, you know, a formula that gives you what your return on that investment would be. So you take the net operating income or EBITDA and divide it by the sale price to get a percentage, 10%. So cap rate of 10% in some markets is good. Some markets, 10% cap rate is not good.
That's interesting. So I hadn't expected it to be, you know, the smaller hotels be valued just on turnover, more or less, just on room rate, which makes it nice and easy, I guess. I guess these things turn over quite a lot. There's so much fuzziness in the accounts anyway. It's a bit of a guess. So is that the number you use to get the sellers interested?
Well, as a broker, our obligation and responsibility is to represent the seller's interest if we're listing the hotel for the seller. But yet, if it's not priced at a market price that is going to interest buyers, then it's just not going to sell. And that doesn't really serve the seller's interest if they really want to sell. So every seller wants to maximize the value, of course, but you have to, you know, educate the seller on what the market is willing to pay. And okay, you can ask maybe a little bit above that. And you know, we look at sale comparables is another valuation method that appraisers for hotels or your house, they look at sale comparables. So getting that data and tracking sale comparables, but there's with hotels, there's always some adjustment in comparing one hotel to another.
So let's talk about headwinds and tailwinds to a sale. Like what are the things, if you're working on the finance team, let's take the case that you're considering you have a group to sell. Like what are the things you should be focusing on in order to deliver that value to the executive team?
I'd advise a seller to first be aware of, which they should be aware of, their guest satisfaction scores, any way that they can improve those, that helps. And that typically involves some capital expenditure to re-carpet or put new wallpaper in the rooms or new furniture and fixtures. And in the hotel industry, there's an acronym for that called the PIP, Product Improvement Plan. And all of the franchise companies, when a hotel sells, in order to continue with that franchise for the new owner, the franchisor will do an inspection of the property and they will generate a PIP, a product improvement plan. And for a 75-key roadside Holiday Inn Express in Du Bois, Pennsylvania, that product improvement plan might be $1.5 million, could be $2 million. So that's a significant aspect of the valuation and the consideration. Just like selling a house, if you can present it so it looks good That's great. And then there's also presenting the numbers because it's an investment. They're buying to get a return on their investment. And so we would also look at the market and maybe ways that a new owner may be able to realize to drive additional top line revenues as well as net more on the bottom line. And so we talk about those upside potentials for the hotel within our offering memorandum. But certainly having the financials, the profit and loss statement organized and clean, that's part of presenting, you know, your best face for the hotel.
So you touched on something there that maybe we should just explain a bit, which is this, you know, you mentioned franchise holders. Maybe you could just explain, where are they holding a franchise? What's the difference between the property owner and the franchise? And what are the motivations for the franchise? And what are the motivations for the property holder?
So in the United States, I believe we have a higher percentage of hotels that are franchised, whereas in Europe, UK and Europe, I think you've got a larger percentage of independent hotels, although the brands have been making considerable headway in the UK and Europe and Asia and everywhere. But the franchisor's interest is to help their franchisees maximize revenue because the franchisor gets a percentage of each hotel's revenue as their income. And they get that right off when you make the reservation off of their property management system software. They know what that is. And so that month, the franchisee gets a bill for, you know, 10%, let's say, of the room revenue that they sold that month. So the interest of the franchisor, like Marriott, Hilton, who don't own their hotels, but they franchise them out, their interest is in maintaining the value of their brand and thereby driving more and more revenue to each and every one of their branded hotels, which in that way, it's aligned with the franchisee. But there are some things from the franchisor side that are not always aligned with the franchisee. And there's usually always a negotiation about the PIP, the product improvement plan, because brands always want the franchisees to spend more to make it as great as possible, at least within the limits of that brand definition. And that's not necessarily always in the interest of the owner of the hotel.
If I'm selling my hotel, if I can do my PIP before I sell, I can sell that as a benefit to the new property owner coming in saying, listen, you're not going to need to spend $1 million. I've already done that for you.
Yeah, especially if that owner has the ability to complete the PIP effectively at, you know, the most efficient cost, the lowest cost, but yet still meeting the brand standards.
You're right about here in Europe, it's slightly a bit different. The only thing I know of similarly, which is going to be very stereotypical, is Guinness and the pubs here in Ireland. So we drink a lot of Guinness, you might have heard. By default, they kind of own the pubs, like, because they have control over mostly what you're going to be selling. In the UK, it's a bit more different. It's much more like a franchise. But in effect, you know, Guinness is operating all these thousands of pubs around the country. And because they set the price, they are effectively setting the margin and they're controlling that business.
Right. It's like BP, British Petroleum, for petrol, for gasoline, or Exxon or whatever.
Yeah. And those guys are trying to make money off the concession and the chocolates and the cigarettes. So you mentioned, you know, obviously I'd expect to have a P&L balance sheet. How can I go one more level beyond that? Just the standard reporting that I might get for any business versus what do you want to see as a broker to be able to market that as well as possible?
Well, there's something in the hotel industry called the Smith Travel Research Report, and most all branded hotels have access to that. And that shows the average of a chosen competitive set. It shows their average daily rate of an average of, say, 5 or 6 or 8 other hotels that are directly compete with that hotel. And Smith Travel Research does this through the connection with all those PMS systems at the permission and behest of the franchisors. So Smith Travel Research Report is one. And of course, a profit and loss statement, a balance sheet is needed, and the lenders who are going to loan the buyer for the mortgage to buy that hotel, which is mostly always financed, they're going to want to see the balance sheet for that hotel as well as the profit and loss statement. Sometimes they'll want to see other reports, cash flow statement. Some hotels are very seasonal. And so that a month-by-month profitability and cash flows, you know, seasonally or month-by-month is something else that some buyers and or the lenders would want to see to know, you know, how much they've got to make in the strong season to carry themselves through the winter or whatever is the slow season.
I guess the best hotels will have like a variety of events. If you're in Las Vegas, there's an event every day of the year. It doesn't really matter. If you're in, I don't know, somewhere more seasonal, then that's going to impact on your evaluations as well. And do certain urban versus rural, is there like a footfall metric or something that goes into this, you know, this overall valuation method?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the capitalization rate is generally lower in major urban markets, although there for a short time from 2020 to 2022, when the government was forcing government in the U.S. and the states, certain states went kind of state by state. Some states were heavy-handed and required hotels to shut down entirely. Other ones were allowed to operate. So it kind of shifted as far as the preference and the profitability of being in a big city versus in a small market during that time. But for the most part, still big urban centers like London, New York City, Miami, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, they have more demand generators for hotel rooms, more reasons that people will go there, like Las Vegas, because there's always convention going on in Las Vegas. Because there are more demand generators, the occupancy is more predictable, less risky. And the risk drives the capitalization rate. So in a small town, you're at risk because you have fewer demand generators. You're also at risk if there's only three hotels in a town, and then somebody says, hey, you guys are doing pretty good, I want to build another hotel here. Happens all the time. Then suddenly that market gets diluted by, you know, 33% or 25%. So that's the other factor in small markets, that it's easier to dilute them or for their business generators to be disrupted, and that can be devastating for a hotel. So that's why capitalization rate valuations, appraisers and buyers and brokers would use a lower cap rate, like in New York City might be a 5% cap rate, whereas in Fairfield, Iowa, where Maharishi International University is, you know, the cap rate might need to be at least 10%, maybe 12%.
Explain that number. Is that the return you'd expect, annualized return based on your investment?
It's the net operating income, which is the net income, but before fixed expenses, before the mortgage, because the buyer's going to have a different mortgage. So you work out what the net operating income, the cash flow available for debt service and profits are. So that's why we calculate prior to debt service.
So there's a couple of elements here I can see coming together which make a roll-up strategy make a lot of sense. If you've got a number of hotels, you're diversifying your risk, which is improves your valuation of the whole group.
Exactly. Yep.
And then you can obviously get better rates on your debt, which is obviously a big driver in this business.
What? Yes.
So all those things, this is why we're seeing groups of 10, 20, 50, 100 hotels.
That's right. And that's what I saw, you know, starting in the 90s as a hotel real estate broker selling hotels, is that my friend Nick, Navnit Patel, who bought his first hotel, a Days Inn in West Virginia. Then Nick bought another hotel. I sold that Days Inn for him. He moved to Pennsylvania, and then he bought another hotel, and then he started building Holiday Inn Expresses. And after building four, five, six Holiday Inn Expresses, he became the developer of the year for IHG, or Holiday Inn Express, for the brand. So I saw those owners sort of, everybody sees top-down consolidation from, say, Marriott buying Starwood, the Sheraton brands, more recently. You see that in the news, but what you didn't see is Nick Patel going from one hotel to 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hotels, or another hotel owner that I know who started with one Econolodge living in a room in the hotel and then bought a second, a third, brought family members in, and they grew their organization to today about 130 hotels.
So this brings us to something that I hadn't realized before I started talking to you, which is there's quite a difference. Like the chains are just interested in the bookings, getting people into the hotel, what touches the guest. But the operator, who's kind of like this stealth thing we don't read about, sounds like quite a good business if you're entrepreneurial and you can be willing to take a bit of risk. You can sort of thing anyone, a man on the street, can get his teeth into. But they have a whole other way of looking at the business, which is the sort of back office, which is managing the cost, I guess, because the only thing they have left to manage is managing the cost down, I'd imagine.
They can impact the top line revenues by, you know, one, providing great service. That comes down to the management and keeping the hotel in great condition. And then, yeah, for the better brands, the brand delivers a higher percentage of the total sales through their reservation system. But sometimes some hotel companies will have a salesperson who goes out and looks for corporate accounts, you know, companies that are visiting the town, doing work in the town, in order to get corporate business, you know, 15 hotel rooms for 45 days or something. So they also, you know, have to work to drive the top line. But then, yeah, they're really focused on maintaining profits and profitability.
What did you see as the opportunity? I see there's this sort of shadow world of owners who have a different set of drivers and interests. They don't really get much help from the brands necessarily. How does HIA serve these guys over just your generic ERP or your QuickBooks or whatever you want to run?
Right. So that one example I gave of a owner who started now some 40 some years ago with one hotel now has 130 in their organization. They actually have more. They are a customer of Hotel Investor Apps. So I had known them back starting in the 90s when I was doing my brokerage, sold hotels to them and sold hotels for them and watched them grow. But what I saw was owners who were, most of those that started smaller were just using QuickBooks, which is fine for even a hotel, even a larger hotel. If the owner is there every day focused on that business, they know what's going on. And so they don't need necessarily a more sophisticated accounting system that can show them in a glance the metrics of the performance of that hotel compared to the 129 other hotels that they own. But as they grew their portfolios, operating each hotel separately, you know, running QuickBooks on an old PC and, you know, in the back office of the hotel and not having any ability to do roll-up accounting, not having automations, which now you've found a market for. You know, there's millions of businesses using QuickBooks today. And for most of those businesses, it's great. It's amazing for them. Sure, better than keeping it on paper, but they need some automations, and your procurement is a great tool for those that are using QuickBooks. But what I saw was in the hotel industry, as an owner went from 1 to 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 hotels, they needed, for one, you know, they're not going to have all those hotels in the same small town. They're going to be separated across states, across the entire country. And so a web-based system where the general managers at each hotel can log in, access the system with very tight user access role restrictions, that so the owner can let that general manager see his hotel, but not the other hotels in the portfolio. Or sometimes an owner might want to let the general manager see certain reports, but not actually see the full profitability of the hotel. Sometimes. I don't advise that necessarily, but that's sometimes they do. So, and I'm going to move to sitting here from standing, but they needed a more robust accounting platform and something that where they could have the same standards, same chart of accounts, same vendor list. Because what we saw is owners, let's say they have 10 hotels and they were doing each hotel separately on QuickBooks. Let's say they've got the exact same vendor list, but at one hotel, they call it Home Depot, and at the other hotel, they call it HD Supply, but it's for the same company. And then you can't do a corporate-wide spend analysis, which I think you probably, you know, you do with your procurement system. But what we saw was, yeah, they had, you know, you have to have certain things standardized. So if you have the same chart of accounts and you have a clean vendor list that's got the same name for a vendor across the whole portfolio, then you can start deriving some deeper analytics to be able to manage a larger portfolio, but still manage it profitably. So that's what we saw.
Yeah, I can echo like lots of the same things. Like we figured out pretty much early in the early days that sometimes what we really got paid for was hiding things, not showing things. Like,
right.
You know, like don't let anyone find out what we're paying the salespeople or.
And that's where the individual user access roles come in. And also, for very good reasons, you don't want somebody that doesn't know how to do accounting messing around and screwing things up in an accounting platform. So you might give the general manager certain access to upload an invoice from a vendor who just dropped something off at the hotel. But you don't want them, you know, maybe approving that invoice and paying it or doing other functions. So the user access roles are important.
What you don't want is them raising invoices in your CRM, taking your deliveries in your point of sale, and then trying to do the accounts out of a third system, because then all hell breaks loose and you don't know what's going on either. So it is a certain stage, especially with a number of locations where people aren't in the same place. Now, maybe you need an audit trail, you need comments, you need to figure out what happened when things go sideways. I mean, we see a lot of the same things, but we kind of do that in QuickBooks, you know, like we provide some of the same functionality in QuickBooks. So I'd like to wrap it up by asking a traditional question I have here, which is, who is your business hero? And I said the word hero to you, you bristled a little bit. So maybe it's not good to idolatrize like that.
Somebody I do admire and I follow on LinkedIn. He's very active on LinkedIn that he posts all the time is Ray Dalio, who's a hedge funds manager. He also practices transcendental meditation. I admire him for his success in managing his large organization. And I think he's put them in a book, but he publishes these principles of the day on LinkedIn all the time. And, you know, I find them to be good advice to follow. So I have found some sage wisdom in Ray Dalio's principles.
And it's very accessible as well. My wife has his book, a coffee table book, and I thought it was some sort of kids book that had been left behind. But, you know, deep stuff, but very accessible, easy to pick up. Yeah, that's a good tip. I think I'm going to follow him on LinkedIn now. So, Charlie, you've been a star. I've learned a lot. I've learned a ton. How can people get in touch with you or find out more?
You can see our website at hotelinvestorapps.com. hotelinvestorapps.com. I know that's a really long URL, but kind of said what we did. You can see more about the company from there and contact us if you want. Also on LinkedIn, and happy to connect with anybody if they'd like to connect there.
Well, I'd recommend people get in touch. I have to say, we met a couple of weeks ago in Austin, and you know, we instantly hit it off. You're very nice way about you. I now know your secret, your DM. Maybe I need to go and take some lessons. Well, thank you very much for listening. If you got this far, this is a part of I've started to interview people who not only work as CFOs or fractional CFOs or on my team, but also, you know, software or service providers that provide value into that market. If you are one of those people, if you either write software or provide a service into the finance function, reach out. You can get me at james.kennedy@procurementexpress.com. And let's have a chat about coming on the show. And we'll see you in the next one.